You're listening to Over the Top, a Great War podcast. I'm your host, Richard Cantu. Please join me as I talk about World War I history and preserve the stories from the soldiers who lived through it. Welcome back, folks. This is episode 64, part two of my Verdun series. And it has been a long pause since the last episode. I'll catch you up shortly. On the last episode, I went back in time to the days of Charlemagne, when the Frankish Empire was formed into Central and Western Europe. By the mid-9th century, the empire that Charles had created ended up being split into three sections after a civil war broke out between his grandsons. And hey, what's family if you can't start a civil war with each other? Am I right? Over the following few centuries after the death of Charles the Great, or Charlemagne as he's known in history, East and West Francia formed into what we know today as France and Germany. By the 12th century, the Franks had evolved into the French, and by the late 15th century, the German nation became known as the Holy Roman Empire of the German Nations. Monarchies, dynasties, kings, and rulers evolved, along with many wars fought in Europe. Who knows how many lives were actually lost during these times? Fast forward to the 17th century when Louis XIV wanted to expand the French Empire, which meant he was going to start picking some fights with people. Alsace and Lorraine, which is the main reason for even discussing this, it was the territory worth every bit of ground to fight over, according to aristocrats, kings, rulers, whatever you want to call them. Again, numerous wars and countless lives were lost fighting over this region during this period of time. It switched hands between the French and Habsburgs many times, and between the French and Germans throughout history. Louis XIV died of gangrene in 1715, and France started to decline, along with losing some costly wars, including the Seven-Year War between 1756 and 1763. Louis XIV actually had a lot of health issues. Historians believe he had diabetes, dental abscesses, which is basically pus forming on the teeth. He had reoccurring boils along with gout. The dude was a mess. Anyways, Prussia in the meantime began to expand its military, becoming a dominant German state. France and Germany, or more accurately, France and Prussia, became foes. In 1789, the French Revolution began, and in 1793, the revolutionaries chopped off Louis XVI and Queen Marie Antoinette's heads by way of guillotine at a place called Place de la Concorde in Paris. Oddly, Prussia and the Habsburgs didn't approve of this. They didn't like that a royal was killed in such a way, even though they'd become foes with France. They didn't like the fact that common folks rounded up the king and queen and executed them. It didn't really matter how they died, just the fact that they killed them. They opposed such behavior because this could poison the minds of their own people, who might try the same thing. Lo and behold, this brought more war. This also brought to the stage the little guy, Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte, who went on a military offensive following the Revolutionary War. Napoleon suffered his final defeat in 1815 at the Battle of Waterloo. I recently seen the movie, I don't know, several weeks ago. It was okay. Out of 10, I don't know. Gave it like a 6-8, maybe a 7. And again, I go back to, you have this story. It's a French story. You don't need to take a Hollywood actor like Joaquin Phoenix to play Napoleon to get good results. I feel like they could have found a French actor. It could have been in French. Maybe that would have made it a little better. You know, focused on him and Josephine maybe a little too much. Again, it was okay. I don't know what you think. I don't know if I'd ever watch it again, but I seen it. It was worth seeing maybe once. That's about that. All right, let me get back on track. After Napoleon's final defeat, this brought on the Congress of Vienna, a diplomatic meeting of the minds to lay out a new map of Europe after the downfall of Bonaparte. A new German confederation was also formed. In 1848, Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, Napoleon III, the little guy's nephew, was elected as the first president of France. Napoleon III was president until 1852, and that was because he promoted himself to emperor. He became Emperor Napoleon III on December 2nd, 1852. Such arrogance! How dare he? Just a bit of fun fact, Napoleon II, the actual son of the little guy, was emperor of France for a couple weeks in 1815. He was like 4 years old at the time. Napoleon I tried to abdicate his son, saying he would be the next emperor in line, but the coalition victors such as Austria, Prussia, Russia, Great Britain, Spain, and more refused to recognize Napoleon II. He lived out most of his life in Vienna and died of tuberculosis brought on from pneumonia in 1832. He was 21 years of age. Another interesting fact about Napoleon II, his remains were transferred from Vienna to Les Invalides, Paris in 1940 by guess who? Adolf Hitler. Yep, completely random and kind of weird, I know. But it's kind of an interesting piece of historical fact. I didn't know this. In fact, when I recently read about it, I was like, interesting. Kind of odd why Adolf Hitler would even care about such a thing. But this is a true fact. Anywho, back to Napoleon III. He wanted to expand France's power through Europe like his uncle. During this time, Prussia was becoming a powerhouse, first showing their power at the Second Schleswig War. I then ended the last episode with Otto von Bismarck writing the Ems Telegraph, which led to France declaring war on Prussia in 1870. During the last episode, I touched on the Second Schleswig War, also known as the Prusso-Danish War. I came across a television series called 1864, and watched it. Really good series. I recommend watching it if you haven't. It's on PBS Masterpiece. There is a couple weird parts in the first episode, but once you get past that, it gets really good, especially when the war starts. I mean, there's a couple scenes in episode one that I was, you know, I thought was very unnecessary. Like, what the hell is going on here? But again, once you get past that, it's good. Really good show about the Second Schleswig War. I believe it came out in 2014. Since I'm on the topic of recommendations, a listener named Steve B, I'll just say B because I don't like to use listeners' full names. A while back, Steve emailed me and recommended a book, It Can't Last Forever, about the 19th Battalion and Canadian Corps in the First World War. On Amazon and eBay, I could only find this in hardcover. I did find a paperback copy from a site called Vital Source. I had to Google it. I look forward to reading it. So thank you for this recommendation, Steve. Cheers to you. Okay. Admin notes, life updates. There's been a lot going on. Say some one negative, one really good. I'll start with a negative. So really kind of goes back to October when I hurt my knee in jiu-jitsu. I could barely walk. It just got me in this real bad funk. I'm still dealing with this today, although it has gotten much better. I've barely gotten to the point in the doctors where I got a steroid shot in my knee. And in July, they're going to do a PRP therapy. And if you're asking what is PRP therapy, I might as well just look it up real quick because I'm not a doctor. I kind of know what it is. Basically, they take blood and inject it in there to get the platelets. But PRP treatment can help support wound healing and trauma and joint injury. The technique can address male pattern, what? Baldness? Or grow, what the hell? Anyways, I don't know what all that baldness and hair is about. the PRP. They're going to extract blood. I don't even know why I looked that up. They're going to take blood, inject it directly straight into the knee where I don't have any more cartilage. And apparently the platelets are going to do its job and it's supposedly going to self-heal itself. That's the best they can do. Anyways, it's from October up till now. And today, as I'm recording this, it's April 19th. I'm barely at that stage where I got the steroid shot and I was able to get an appointment to get the PRP therapy in July. So again, I haven't been doing jiu-jitsu. I can't do anything. At a point, I could barely even walk. It just put me in this huge funk. I was just down, depressed. And I know you guys might be saying, oh, go down to McDonald's and get yourself a Whamburger and some French fries. I don't, trust me. I'm not feeling sorry for myself. I've just never been put in a situation where I was almost immobile. I could barely walk. It just was a really bad feeling. Didn't like it. Put me in this huge funk. But it's getting better. And one of the positive things I think that happened is my job career change. I finally got my foot into the door with a fire department as a reserve doing inspections because my goal is to be an inspector. That I am so pumped up for that. I went to school for quite a while to get my certifications. Finally got my foot in the door. And it's funny, like right as this was happening, I think my knee quickly started to get better. And I'm no doctor. I don't know what it is, but I feel like when you have positive energy, your body does better. That's what I think. It's my personal feelings. I have no anything to back that up, but just the way I feel. So that's super positive. I've been busy with that. So yeah, just a few things. So anyways, had to take a long break because of the job. I was in a funk, but I'm back here. I'm recording. I feel great. I will have to warn you, though, if you hear some running around in the background, my bulldog, which I don't know if I ever say his name's Bruno. I don't know why I've never said his name at this point, but he had an ear infection a couple weeks ago. We're giving him ear drops. He goes kind of nuts when I give him these ear drops. So I'm leaving the door open. He's fine right now, but he might go running back and forth. Poor little guy. He's not little. He's 67 pounds now. I think that's about it for life updates. What else can I say? Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't want to keep making excuses, but that's kind of what the big pause was about. I can't say there's not going to be another one. If I am in the future going to have to take a few more classes for the inspector. I don't think it should be such a long pause, though. Those don't last too long. So, yeah. Anyways, that's what's going on. A lot of positivity in my life right now, despite the knee setback. Not back in jiu-jitsu yet. I don't know when I'm going to be back. I'll be honest. If I was offered a full-time position, they said, hey, we can't afford to have you get hurt, be out like you were, down like you were, so you can't do jiu-jitsu and we'll give you this job. It would be a no-brainer for me. I would walk away from jiu-jitsu for this job any day. I've done jiu-jitsu a long time. It's part of me. I get depressed when I don't do it. Not depressed. I'm better mentally when I do it, but it's just way more important in my life to me. There's other things that I can find eventually that will give me that sort of satisfaction physically. So, yeah, I know that was long and drawn out. Hopefully I'm not boring you too much, but that's what's going on. Okay, let me get into part two of the Verdun series. We know that France declared war on Prussia. That paper has been stamped. But it's important to first explain the state of France's military versus Prussia's at the time. Going into the Franco-Prussian War, France was supposed to have had roughly around 800,000 troops, which included what they believed was around 400,000 in reforms. This wasn't the case, though. They truly only had around 500,000 troops ready. The Prussians, who remember are the North German Federation, had only around 300,000 troops available. Excuse me. However, Prussia had a healthy amount of reserves, which if needed would increase their size up to 1 million. The South Germanic states could field another 200,000. On paper, the Germans had numerical superiority. But keep in mind, numbers when it comes to troops available, including reserves, heavily rely on the speed at which a military can mobilize and deploy its troops. And also keep in mind, These were rough estimates at the time. But regardless, these numbers should have raised a concern for the French. However, French commanders were not concerned. They believed they had more of a professional military than Prussia, and that's because their conscripts had served for at least 7 years, which they believe gave their military an edge for experience over Prussia. By 1870, about half of the French force were believed to have had more than 7 years of active service, compared to the Prussian force who had about 3 years worth of active service. But years later, French officers recounted somewhat of a different situation. They said instead of having professional and experienced soldiers, they often had a lot of men in their 50s or 60s. Men who at this point were sort of jaded and often spent more time drinking rather than drilling as soldiers. For a Prussian soldier, during his 3 year active duty time, he would go through rigorous physical training, target shooting practice, along with theoretical war lectures and principles. The Prussian officers instilled in their soldiers ethics, discipline, morals, while promoting the spirit of defending the fatherland. Actually, ethics and morals can be questioned, but we won't go down that road right now. If you want my opinion, the Prussian army sounded more professional. They seemed to have it together more than the French military, who sounded like a bunch of old guys that continually got sauced in the local watering hole. Another thing to point out, the Prussians had some form of basic education and literacy, while the French lacked in that department. This is important when it comes to reading maps, reading orders, and relaying orders, and just overall learning what soldiers are supposed to learn. Having an education makes things go easier. You don't want to be a dumbass or a rock, as we called them. The French also held a lottery every year, allowing a buyout from military service for 2,400 francs. Clearly, this was intended for the wealthy, while the uneducated folks around France wouldn't be able to afford this, so this was of no benefit to them. Also, promotion in the French army at this time was absolutely horrible. It could take a whole decade to advance in rank. It was common for a junior officer to be in his 50s or 60s. So I guess getting sauced might have been justified, because that's just not right. Anyway, I think you get the picture. On paper, Prussian troops seem to be a better soldier. Another important thing to note, and this time in favor of France, is that they had more advanced weapons than the Prussians. 1 point for the French. Now, here's a crazy tactic that the French decided to start with. Even though it was they who declared the war, they decided to take a defensive stance, while Moltke planned for an offensive approach. Moltke's aim was to strike fast and hard. The French also took more of a traditional approach on troop positions. The infantry were tightly grouped in battalions. With their superior rifles, the men would fire in organized fashion. The positions were strengthened with artillery, which were formed into what they called great batteries behind the infantry. Such firepower would cut down any approaching force. Right behind all those packed lines would be heavy cavalry tasked with making decisive blows and breakthroughs. However, what the French failed to learn from the Crimean War is that with modernized weapons and any cavalry charge would be suicide. Now, this sort of defense would make sense if the Germans approached in straight lines or packed groups. The French commanders failed to acknowledge that the Prussians adopted new tactics in warfare, really making their defensive positions sort of obsolete. I have to give it to Moltke. His thoughts about battlefield tactics were advancing with the times. We haven't quite gotten into modern warfare like the Great War yet, but there was advancements in warfare during the Franco-Prussian War. Moltke was a change agent who adopted to the newer weapons and tactics on the battlefield. His focus was on maneuverability and flexibility. And to give them the flexibility and maneuverability, he gave the commanders the capability to break down the units into smaller platoons. Obviously, you could move quicker in smaller groups. Moving large groups of soldiers can be like herding fish into a fry basket. Just becomes a cluster, you know what. But the French believed they would easily gun down these smaller units with their superior rifles. What they didn't know is that Moltke never intended to send the troops in a straight line directly at them. Instead, the Prussians would spread out, flank, and encircle the French defenses. There's still the artillery problem for the Prussians, though. Moltke reorganized his own artillery into smaller, more mobile batteries. They could move and redeploy much quicker across the battlefield as needed. The Prussian military was also the first to use civilian technologies in wartime, railways and telegraph. Moltke was in fact the first general to use electronic messaging to relay his orders. This drastically cut down time to relay important information to field commanders. But I'll reiterate, you can have advanced weapons, better tactical plans, whatever it may be, but the speed at which you can get your troops deployed really plays a key role. France actually had a chance to strike first, since it was estimated that it would take Prussia at least 7 weeks to mobilize its forces, while France would deploy rather quickly, probably half the time. Even the French citizens wanted their army to strike first. They wanted Prussia to be punished for their insolence. But French commanders didn't really have an offensive plan. Napoleon III ended up splitting his army into three pieces, putting the First Corps under Marshal Patrice McMahon in the Alsace region, the Sixth Corps under Marshal François Canrobert in Chalons, and the Army of the Rhine under his own imperial command at Metz. I don't know if this matters. Actually, maybe it does. Historians believe that Napoleon was really only out to gain a military victory in his name, to gain a sort of notch on his belt. You know, it was me, all me sort of fame. Look at what I did, like my uncle. He ordered one of his best commanders, who was looking after the Rhine army, Marshal Bazaine, to do nothing without his permission. His other great commanders were sent to command the smaller corps. His headquarters had no actual military experience, just like himself. HQ was overseen by Marshal Edmond Lebeuf, no relation to Shia Lebeuf. He was supported by Generals Lebrun and Gérard. When Napoleon arrived in Metz on July 28th, he asked Bazaine to assist with planning an offensive. But I think Bazaine was really just over it at this point. He didn't offer anything. Marshal Patrice McMahon, on the other hand, took some initiative and tried to offer some advice on how to proceed, but was ignored. This is what led Lebeuf and Lebrun to choose a defensive position. McMahon, in French it's pronounced McMahon, obviously in Irish, or I guess it would be Scottish, McMahon. I'm going to say McMahon. McMahon is an interesting guy when it comes to history. I won't go deep into him, but I'll just say he became president of France from 1875 to 1879. He is of Irish descent, and his full name is Marie Edmond Patrice Maurice de McMahon. No, I didn't make that up. That was his name. Anywho, the Army of the Rhine at Lorraine would lay in wait for the Prussians to arrive as instructed by Napoleon. There were some disturbances in his ranks. That's a professional way of putting it. Disturbances in the ranks. In other words, there was no synergy between Napoleon and his commanders. And Napoleon had other problems besides his command. By later July, only 2/3 of his force had been deployed. The rail lines were jammed up, troops arrived in much smaller numbers, often without their weapons. It was one big cluster. On top of that, the popularity for the war had dwindled down, even with the French citizens who'd previously been calling to strike first. Hang on.
You okay? You lay down? Okay.
All right. Sorry about that. What was it? Okay. And because of this, now unpopularity for the war, Napoleon was forced to leave back roughly around 15,000 troops just to keep his throne secure. Napoleon and his commanders quickly realized they didn't have enough troops, so they issued a call for volunteers. And check this out. It's estimated that France's population around this time was, we'll call it 35 million or so, give or take a million. What the hell? Well, only 4,000 men enlisted for the call to arms. This alone tells the story how quickly this war had become unpopular with the French citizens. But then again, honestly, when has the citizens' opinion ever really mattered with something like this? The French soldiers' morale at this point hit an all-time low. Soldiers were literally just dropping pieces of their equipment or tossing it into the woods. Units would wander off into nearby villages or towns looking for entertainment and would get drunk off their asses. And I'm saying entertainment with air quotes. Recruits would flat out ignore their officers and question their orders. Complete insubordination within the ranks. News of this behavior made it all the way up to Napoleon, and this was a complete punch in his gut because he was aiming to gain military victories just like, you guessed it, his uncle. And a victory against the Prussians at Alsace-Lorraine would have elevated his status quo. But losing the morale from his troops helped in no sort of way. This was a gut-wrenching feeling for him. As the days went on, it was only getting worse for the French emperor. Opposite of him, the Germans, well, they were actually gaining strength as the mobilization went on. The Prussian military had been conducting mobilization drills prior to this, so mobilizing wasn't really an issue for them. Prussia also had better rail lines at this time. They had about five times as many trains running daily compared to the French. They seemed to be a well-oiled machine. And I'm not saying that no German or Prussian soldier got drunk and out of hand during the process. What I'm saying is it was at a much lower scale than the French soldiers. We know the Germans love their beer, and I'm sure beer was consumed during the mobilization process. This was kind of natural back then. And hey, a little suds in moderation, if drunk responsibly, never hurt nobody, right? Moltke prepared for the French to attack first, so he positioned his troops behind the Rhine, Saar, and Moselle rivers, using the waterways as a natural barrier. He divided his forces into three armies. The first army, under the command of General Karl von Steinmetz, was located at the northernmost sector of the line between Trier and Saarlouis, basically east of Luxembourg. The second army was in the center near Saarbrücken and was commanded by Prince Frederick Karl. The second was considered the largest of the Prussian forces. Prince Frederick Karl was from the House Hohenzollern and was the son of Prince Charles of Prussia. Sounds Game of Thrones-ish, but sometimes these royal titles, especially in Prussia and Germany, can get confusing, just like the following. The Third Army was under the command of Crown Prince Frederick Wilhelm, the heir to the Prussian throne, or also known as Frederick III, German Emperor. Frederick is also a scion of the House Hohenzollern. His father was Prince Wilhelm, or Wilhelm I. Wilhelm I was King of Prussia from 1861 and German Emperor from 1871 until his death in 1888. When Wilhelm I took the throne of Prussia, this made Frederick III a crown prince. Kaiser Wilhelm, who we famously know from the Great War, was the son of Frederick III. You can go deep into this monarchy malarkey, so I won't discuss any further about that topic. So, the Third Army was under the command of Crown Prince Wilhelm, aka Frederick III, and they were positioned towards the southeast around Karlsruhe. This southernmost force consisted mostly of soldiers from Bavaria, Baden, and Württemberg. Moltke remained skeptical of their willingness to do their part, so he didn't provide their junior officers with the same detailed maps as the Prussians had. Napoleon was feeling the pressure from the public to either crap or get off the pot. General Charles Frossard had advocated for an attack at Saarbrücken. On July 29th, Emperor Napoleon authorized the attack. The French soldiers began advancing into Germany. On August 2nd, the attacks began, but they were very minor, more of skirmishes than battles that quickly got broken up. Multiple French divisions approached Saarbrücken, and the single German division there quickly withdrew. Napoleon and Frossard immediately hailed this as a victory, but just as quick as they took the city and celebrated, they probably withdrew even quicker after realizing the Prussians were just finishing up their mobilization and the bulk of their troops were approaching from the Rhine. This caused a major rift between Marshal Bazaine and Napoleon. Bazaine, who was higher ranking than Frossard and had more military experience, was put into a supporting position. Bazaine viewed this whole attack on Saarbrücken as pure horse crap, unless they committed to a hard push deep into Prussia. Bazaine even offered to move to an enveloping position on Saarbrücken, but his request was ignored. At this point, Bazaine became a negative critic to this whole operation and to Napoleon's military talent, or therefore lack of. Marshal McMahon was basically left with no support due to Napoleon and Lebouf's plan. If you were a military commander during this time, you'd want your intelligence to come from probably cavalry scouts getting eyes on. That's probably the most credible piece of intelligence you had back then. Napoleon was getting his intel from newspapers and foreign correspondents, which often was one-sided, much like news is today. Seeing that the French were holding the line at Metz, Moltke disregarded the stunt by the French at Saarbrücken, swung his 3rd Army at McMahon's 1st Corps into the Vosges mountain range, then swung into the north, forcing the French into a pocket. Yes, this was a risky maneuver by Moltke because it possibly could have cut off his 3rd Army from the rest of the Prussian forces for several days. But Moltke had confidence in the Crown Prince and because of the overall difference in troop numbers. The Prussian 3rd Army had around 125,000 versus McMahon's 45,000. That's the size difference between an army and a corps back then. The French High Command had no idea this maneuver had taken place until they got word about it from interrogated Prussian prisoners. The Prussian 3rd Army made their initial attack on August 4th when they attacked a single French division defending Wissembourg, which is north of Strasbourg. Wissembourg had an old 18th century fort that overlooked an important junction for Bavaria, now also Strasbourg and Lower Alsace. McMahon had only 4 divisions total that were spread out to cover the entire southern French flank across the Vosges. He was way too thinly spread out. This gave him almost zero time to reposition troops if needed during a Prussian attack. On the morning of August 4th, French cavalry made contact with the Prussians. Immediately it seemed that the French had the upper hand as the mitrailleuse shredded the oncoming soldiers approaching Wissembourg. The mitrailleuse is a close relative of the Gatling gun. It could either fire all rounds through multiple barrels at once, or it could fire in rapid succession. And if a soldier was struck by a mitrailleuse, you're talking about the body getting shredded to pieces. I mean, completely torn apart. The French also had the Chassepot rifle, officially known as the Fusil Modèle 1866. It was a bolt-action breech-loading rifle. For those that don't understand what breech loading is, it's opposite of a muzzle loader, which would be from the front of the barrel. A breech loader is from the rear or breech end of the barrel. For the time, this was a quite sophisticated rifle. to operate it, you would have to cock the action, then pull the bolt back. These are separate functions on the rifle. Then you load the round, close the bolt, and bang. I've heard the recoil on this isn't that bad, and it fires fairly accurately. Although, one issue I see that probably plagued the troops was the buildup of soot. Probably after 5 rounds or so, I'd imagine it would really start to build up in the chamber. Black powder was used and would cause a buildup of soot, and could really hinder the operation of the weapon if not clean. I mean, the bolt could maybe even get jammed going back. Also, with black powder smoke, this could possibly have caused some eye irritation. But yeah, the French were taking well-aimed shots at the Prussians, who were advancing along with the mitrailleuse and artillery tearing them apart. So, not a bad start for the French out the gate. But the French quickly lost their advantage. Prussian commanders became aware that there was only a single French division held up in this fort. They immediately spread out and began their enveloping tactics. Soon, after a few of the Prussian artillery guns had crossed the Lauter River, which we know as the Rhine River, the Prussian artillery provided supporting fire while the troops moved up to the town of Wissembourg. The town turned into this sort of door-to-door close combat arena. The mayor pleaded with the troops to withdraw in order to prevent civilian deaths. Some French did, but the majority of the French troops had no choice but to make a stand and fight. They were literally encircled. By the afternoon, Wissembourg was in German hands, and the dead and wounded were roughly neck and neck. Each side suffered around 1,500 casualties. However, the Germans took several hundred more French POWs. The Prussian commanders learned two lessons from the fighting at Wissembourg. First, although the Chassepot was a better rifle from both precision and range, because the French had crammed its soldiers into one spot instead of spreading them out, this made it easy for the German artillery just to pummel them. Second, Prussia learned that the Bavarian troops were basically just slightly better than the French. They weren't anything amazing to write home about. In fact, they lacked discipline. Commanders said this was especially true when they came under heavy fire. They often just fired their weapons without aiming, fired too early, and ignored direct orders. But they weren't trained like the Prussians. So for the oncoming weeks of the war, they would hammer their discipline into the Bavarian troops. So as the German Third Army pushed up through the south, Moltke's plan to bunch the French up was working. His next move was to strike the French's new position at Spicheren and Forbach, just south of Saarbrücken. This was an important supply depot for the French commanders. This was the Battle of Spicheren, also known as the Battle of Forbach. By me saying Moltke's plan was to bunch them up, what this means is that since the French were bunched up and with his second army attacking at the center, this would allow the first German army to move in from the north and the third from the south, really just ganging up on the French. This was Moltke's plan. But his grand plan was almost ruined by General Steinmetz, full name Karl Friedrich von Steinmetz, who I believe he was like 74, 75 years old when the Franco-Prussian War was started. Needless to say, he was just a little over the hill, past his prime, probably shouldn't have been there in the first place. Other commanders said he was showing signs of senility or he was becoming senile. Which is really quite sad that a man of his age would still be involved in a war. But he was a hero to the Prussian people and a close friend of King Wilhelm, who assured him a commanding position. Well, Steinmetz decided to ignore Moltke's orders. Instead of moving his forces across the Saar River, he instead opted to move his forces south toward Fossard. By doing this, he cut off the advance of the Second Army. So it was the First Army that engaged the center of the French forces. Part of Steinmetz's force reached Spicheren on August 6th, and because what appeared to be the French in retreat, Stangney ordered a full-on attack on what was believed to be the French rear guard. But the French were not in retreat. General Frassard dug his men into fighting positions using the hilly terrain to his advantage. Moltke's plan was beginning to fall apart. The French fighting positions had a greater advantage over the approaching Germans. And all this was happening because of Steinmetz. But it gets worse for Steinmetz and his commanders. Instead of waiting for all the forces to get online, they just sent in a couple battalions who'd arrive first. And yes, the German artillery was able to hold the French off for some time, but eventually the Germans took too many casualties. They'd become overwhelmed by the French guns and had to retreat. And the Germans quickly realized this wasn't the French rearguard that they were dealing with. Frassard then agreed to a counterattack. This pushed both the retreating and arriving Germans back further. Here's the thing though. The counterattack was minor. Had Frassard unleashed the full potential of the French during the counterattack, they might have dealt a serious enough blow to the Germans, enough maybe to have even defeated the Prussians during this war. But Frassard didn't. He stayed true to his defensive strategy, refusing to leave the high ground. This gave the Prussians enough time to regroup. Soon after, Prince Friedrich Karl's forces began to arrive and amass its troops. They slowly began to push the French back while at the same time fanned out the units to begin encirclement. But remember, this was a battle. During all of this, there's bullets flying everywhere and artillery raining down from both sides. A lot of men were dying on both sides. But the Prussian discipline prevailed. They continued to advance relentlessly. They maintained their lines despite taking casualties. The Prussian artillery was also growing in size as they arrived, also finding better firing positions, which put a lot of pressure on Frassard and his forces. This was too much for Frassard. By the evening, he ordered a full retreat back to the defensive line on the Moselle River. Overall, the Battle of Spicheren on August 6th was an almost disaster for the Prussians. But because of Frassard's stance on using defensive tactics over offensive, this played in favor for Prussia. Prussia took around 4,800 casualties and the French took around 4,100. The Chassepot rifle was credited for playing a major role in this battle for the French. And this was just the beginning. All right, folks, that's going to be it for this episode. I will jump back in episode 65 to finish off the Franco-Prussian War before we jump back in, or I should start with, Verdun. Folks, thank you for listening to this episode and for your continued support. You fans are the best. Again, I know it was a small little break. I'm back on track. I'm feeling great, motivated. We're doing good. All right, folks, it is Friday night. I'm going to get ready to watch, what is the movie? Late Night with the Devil that just came out on Shudder with the wife. I'm going to make us a few cocktails. We're going to sit down and watch this. And I'm not going to lie, I'm probably going to sleep with one eye open. But hey, that's what it's about. Until the next episode, take care, everyone.